Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 301. How do you avoid the risk of running a Python application locally that could be malicious, break your code, or leak private data? How can you create a sandboxed local environment using WASM and MicroPython? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We cover a recent article by previous guest Simon Willison, titled Running Python Code in a Sandbox with MicroPython and WASM. Simon has been experimenting for years on how to run Python code in a sandbox to reduce the risk of trying out new software, untrusted libraries, and wild ideas. He's developed a solution using WebAssembly and MicroPython and is sharing it as an alpha package on PyPI. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including new releases, community announcements, a roundup of recent Real Python tutorials and video courses, a plugin case study using Pluggy, are you expected to run 5 type checkers now, wrapping programs using the subprocess module, a project for star charts and maps, and a tool for trend detection in Python. This episode is sponsored by DataDriven. DataDriven helps Python and data engineers walk into interviews ready. You take on the kind of problems you'll face on the job and get pushed the way a sharp interviewer would, on the edge cases and failure modes that catch people off guard. So find your gaps before your interviewer does. Start at datadriven.io. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, short break. We're back again.
Break.
Yeah, exactly.
No break week after week.
Yeah.
You're going to make me work 2 days in 2 weeks? That seems wrong.
Sorry. All right. Well, we got a bunch of news. I have another group of Real Python news for everybody, and then our typical topics and projects this week. Are you ready to dig in?
Sure. Let's do this.
All right.
When I first wrote this, I wrote a medium amount of news this week, but then it started gathering, so I'm not sure still got a medium amount of news.
True.
Anyways, I'm going to start off with the Python Software Foundation board elections. Dates have been announced for the 2026 election. Nominations open on July 28th and run to August 11th. Then the election itself is the first 2 weeks of September. The recent creation of the Packaging Council means you get 2 elections for the price of 1. So both the PSF board and the Package Council as well.
I got my email this week.
Did you?
Yeah.
Sticking with the PSF, Python 3.15 Beta 3 has come out. They just keep plugging away. Not much to say there. Bug fix, bugs fix, bug fix. And now switching to PEPs. PEP news has been busy and slow at the same time. Busy because a bucket load of PEPs got marked as final. Too many to list. And as they've entered final state, we've already talked about most of them earlier in the process when they got approved, etc.
Yeah.
The one new PEP to talk about is PEP 835, titled Shorthand Syntax for Annotated Type Metadata. I'm going to try and do this and sound like I'm interested. Annotations.
Oh, we got more types for you later,
typing, yay! So this PEP has to do with how extra information or constraints get added to a type declaration. Say you're declaring a class with a name field, you can specify name colon string to indicate to the type checker that it is in fact a string. That's basic type checking. Now, if you want to specify a constraint, like the length of the string has to be at least 3 or is 3, like a country code, you can currently use the annotated class from the typing module to add this information. This works, but it's rather verbose, which is kind of my complaint about typing in the first place. So the PEP is adding some syntax. If this goes through, you'll be able to use the at symbol to associate this kind of annotated information. So now it would be name colon string at field with min length equals 3 inside of the field. This saves some typing, makes the whole thing easier to read, for some definition of easier. This PEP is currently in draft status and is targeted for 3.16, so we'll see if it gets accepted. The next bit of news is more community stuff. The Django Software Foundation has announced that it's creating a new paid position for an executive director. This person would handle the day-to-day operations of the various working groups and deal with the logistics of a nonprofit organization. Up until now, this has been done with volunteers, and it's starting to become overwhelming. The exact job description will be announced shortly, so this is more of an announcement to tell you that there will be an announcement. This is coming about because they got a sponsorship. There's a company that's willing to help pay for this, and that'll free up some of the volunteer folks to be able to go back to coding and things. While on the topic of Django, 6.1 Beta 1 has come out, so features are frozen and it's all bug fixes until the targeted August release date. Yep, that's right, August. I definitely said December in the past because that's when I thought they were, yeah. But I looked it up and their actual release plan is every 8 months, which is why the .0 releases always end up in December because it cycles. So partial credit for me, failing grade for broadcasting incorrect information. Django 6.1 in August.
All right.
And the last bit of news is quick. The videos from this year's PyData London conference are now up on YouTube. As you might expect nowadays, there are a bunch of talks on using LLMs and other ML models with data, along with the usual stuff on stats, a talk on Jupyter Notebooks, dealing with noisy data, and lots more. So if you're interested in the data side of things, a whole bunch of videos there for you to check out.
All right. Continuing from last week, I'm going to provide a bunch of real Python news here for the second half of June. A new tutorial written by Leodonis Pozo Ramos, implementing interfaces in Python, ABCs, and protocols. In object-oriented programming, an interface describes the methods a class must implement to play a specific role. This set of methods expresses the interface contract. Python has no dedicated syntax for interfaces, but it gives you two mechanisms for modeling them, abstract base classes and protocols. Python's everyday duck typing takes advantage of both of these. Through the tutorial, you'll write code examples that model interfaces with ABCs and protocols and rely on duck typing for behavior-based contracts. There's a new video course by instructor Roxana Annabelle Lofuente. It's titled Building Python Skills for the Job Market. When you're learning Python, the sheer volume of topics to explore can feel overwhelming because there's so much you could focus on. Should you dive into web frameworks before exploring data science? Is test-driven development something you need right away? And which skills actually matter to employers in the age of AI-assisted software development? Python itself is relatively beginner-friendly, but its versatility makes it easy to wander without direction. Without a clear plan, you can spend months studying topics that won't help you land your first developer job. This video course is there to show you how to build a focused learning strategy that aligns with job market demands. I know I just mentioned his name a minute ago, but we have another written tutorial by Leodonis. It's titled Context Engineering for Python Codebases. Context engineering is the practice of curating the content that goes into an AI agent's context window. We've been talking about it a lot lately, and it's actually going to come up more in a few upcoming episodes. But in Python projects, that may mean pinning your dependency manager in an extraction file, trimming irrelevant history, delegating heavy tasks to subagents, and more. And he explains through this piece how most agents' failures come from bad context, not necessarily a bad model. Bigger context windows don't fix poor curation. They only delay the symptoms. Instruction files like agents.markdown keep your Python conventions in front of the agent, and then how curating, distilling, delegating, and externalizing are all strategies to help you manage an agent's context. And we have a new tutorial by Ian Ayer, Python for Data Analysis, a Practical Guide. Data analysis with Python has become a default workflow in this industry, thanks to mature ecosystems of libraries like Pandas, NumPy, Matplotlib, and scikit-learn. Once you've analyzed your data, you can use findings to make sound business decisions, improve procedures, and even make informed predictions. Throughout the tutorial, you work in Jupyter Notebooks and use a variety of Python data tools to explore the different stages of the data analysis workflow. We have a new video course from instructor Stephen Loyens. It's titled Using Llama Index for RAG in Python. And throughout the course, you'll discover how to use Llama Index with practical examples. Llama Index lets you load your data and documents, create and persist searchable indexes, and query an LLM using your data as context. And to wrap up this list, we have a new written tutorial by Vivek Sahu. It's titled Django Tasks, Exploring the Built-in Tasks Framework. Django apps often need to defer slower work to be outside the request response cycle. Django Tasks is the new built-in framework that came in Django 6.0. And it gives you a standard way to push that work onto a background worker instead of a view function that keeps a user's browser waiting. Common examples of such work include like sending welcome emails, processing image uploads, and generating monthly reports. And before Django Tasks, you'd probably reach for something like Celery or RQ or Django Queue. Each of these has its own API, broker setup, and learning curve. This new framework standardizes a workflow for you. So that's what's been happening the last couple of weeks at realpython.com. All right, you ready to dig into your first topic?
Sure. My first article this week is by Eli Bendersky, and it's titled Plugins Case Study, Pluggy. One way of making your software more extensible is by providing a way to install plugins that interact with it and change its behavior. Eli's article is about Pluggy, a framework for dealing with plugins. In fact, it's the plugin system that PyTest uses, so this isn't just a little toy library. Pluggy works by defining hooks. If you're familiar with PyTest, it probably won't surprise you that you define hooks through the use of decorators. PyTest's answer to everything is decorators. Eli's article runs you through how to build a pluggable system. In an earlier article by Eli on general pluggable systems, he built HTMLIs, a toy tool that takes a text markup language and spits out HTML. So in this article, he follows up on that and guides you through the same concept, but using Pluggy to enhance it instead of his general mechanism. The first two problems you need to solve when dealing with plugins is how to find them and how to register them inside the code that is going to consume the plugins. This kind of code is called the host in Pluggy parlance. The finding plugins part is known as discovery, and then the registration part in Pluggy is done through an API. So you can write your own discovery system as long as it calls that same registration method, you'll be fine. That said, Pluggy does come with one built-in discovery mechanism for you, and it's PyProjectTomlAware. So if your plugins are all in the same Python file, you can add a project.entrypoints section to PyProjects.toml, where you associate a module with an object, and then Pluggy does the rest, loading those plugins in and gets them going for the host software. Inside your host code that uses the plugins, you access any registered plugins through the Pluggy plugin manager. I tried to say plug in that last sentence one more time, but started going off on a tangent about electrical sockets and stopped. What the plugin manager holds is one or more hooks. The hooks are the API to the plugged in code. So as I mentioned, you define a hook through the use of a decorator. This is called hook spec, and typically your hook is just a function with an empty body. Well, not empty, pass. But, you know, technically you can't do empty. But what we're trying to do here is create a function signature, which is the important part. And that's what tells Pluggy what your hook looks like and allows you to call any registered plugins for that hook. So inside your host code, you query the plugin manager for the hook that you want at that point in the code, and you get back an iterator of plugins for that hook type, which you can then iterate through and call as you need. So all that's very, very vague. In the article, Eli demonstrates a plugin that he calls Narcissist, which puts an author attribution at the end of the generated HTML. Remember, this tool takes some markup-like stuff and spits out HTML. So his toy code has a hook that allows you to modify the output of the contents buffer, which in the case of the Narcissist plugin merely appends a name to the end of the buffer. So Eli shows you how to write the plugin, how to use the plugin inside of the host code, how to wire it all up with PyProjects, and so you've got a nice little concrete example of how all these pieces fit together. At the end of the article, Eli talks a bit about whether it's worth using Pluggy. Plugin mechanisms aren't terribly complicated, especially in a language like Python that allows for dynamic loading, but Pluggy has some features that you might want to take advantage of. One, it's tried and true and tested, and it's been used in a pretty large library, so that's good. Why write it again? Two, that whole PyProjects TOML thing is kind of handy. And three, it has some special handling mechanisms that allow you to define things like what order plugins fire in. The default is just the order of registration, but there are things like first result, try first, try last, and these give you more control if you want. So if you're interested in how plugin systems work, both of Eli's articles are worth checking out. But if you actually need one of them, Pluggy is probably the way to go.
Awesome. I'll actually be speaking about it a little bit more here in a moment. If you got a Python or data interview coming up, take a look at Data-Driven. Their problems replicate real-world Python issues, like parsing messy data, dedupe, sessionization, the things teams hire you to do. Your answer gets pressure tested the same way it would in a code review, the Unicode case you forgot, the daylight saving boundary, the code that quietly crawls at scale. You find the weak spots during your practice instead of in the interview, and walk in knowing your solution holds up under scrutiny. It's all at datadriven.io. I've got two little pieces that are coming from the WebAssembly Python space. I know I talk about WebAssembly often and kind of want to keep people abreast of what's happening there. On the PyAdide blog, they have an announcement about PyAdide. I don't know if I should just read it as 314 or 314.0 release. In fact, that's part of it here. There's a couple key items that are in this release and in this announcement. They're making an intentional version jump from 0.29 to 314.0. So PyAdide versioning now dynamically tracks CPython versions. Moving forward, version 314.x aligns directly to Python 3.14. So ensuring sort of clarity as they kind of continue forward. So I would guess their next version would be, you know, a next major version would be 315, 315.0. So to fully standardize the packaging process under PEP 783, they wanted to stabilize platform compatibility for packages so they don't break with every PyAdide release. Therefore, they're transitioning to a Python version-based versioning scheme. And that's their next note is about PEP 783 and how it was accepted, which is a big win for the WebAssembly packaging instead of PyAdide maintainers hand-building and hosting around 300 third-party packages. Anyone can now use the CI build wheel to publish PyAdide-compatible WASM wheels directly to PyPI. They've written a comprehensive guide on building and publishing that, and they have links to it there if you're interested in publishing PyAdide wheels to PyPI. They've locked the binary compatibility. Built packages are guaranteed to remain compatible throughout a given Python release cycle, preventing minor updates from breaking existing deployments. And there's a few standard library improvements. Popular built-in modules, specifically SQLite 3, SSL, and LZMA, are now bundled into the default runtime environment. They were previously removed to limit the size of the PyAdide distribution, and it now eliminates the need for like manual await PyAdide.load package and calling them back in. Now we'll streamline the onboarding process. They're trying something experimental with Node.js TCP sockets. PyAdide can now establish direct TCP database connections. And they've tested it with MySQL, PostgreSQL, and Redis when you're running in a Node.js environment. So a handful of things. Again, some of this stuff is kind of mirroring other development things where people are trying to stabilize not only what's happening with WASM and PyAdide here and WASI. I've talked to Brett Cannon recently about that to say, okay, we need to say all of this works with this version of Python, which I think is good and maybe making things a little less confusing. And my other piece in the WebAssembly world here is from previous guest Simon Wilson. He's been experimenting on ways to run code in a sandbox for several years, and he has a new blog post titled Python in a Sandbox with MicroPython and WASM. So this might sound familiar. I had Chris Laffer on the show back in episode 226. he talked about his project. It was called PySheets. If you remember, the idea was that he wanted to Excel to run in Python as opposed to Python and Excel. And anyway, he wanted it to be able to load quickly. And so he was looking at a way to have MicroPython work inside of PyScript and had created a scheme around that. So I think this idea has been bouncing around for a while. Why does Simon want a sandbox? He is a fan of building plugin architecture. He likes to add to his open source projects. He has a very popular project called Dataset and another one called LLM. I'll just read a quick quote from his piece here. My software can grow a new feature overnight. I don't even have to review a pull request. There's one major drawback. My plugin systems all use Python and Pluggy, and plugin code executes with full privileges within my applications. A buggy or malicious plugin could break everything or leak private data. I'd love to be able to run plugin-style code in an environment where it is unable to read unapproved files, connect to a network, or generally operate in a way that's risky or harmful to the rest of the application or the user's computer. So I'm just going to add a few other notes from his piece here. He has a list of specs that he really wanted from the sandbox. So he kind of goes through and itemizes features that he wanted. And WebAssembly looked like promising on most of those formats. He started to look at PyDide. It offers an outstanding package for running Python using WebAssembly in the browser, but PyDide in server-side Python isn't supported. PyDide is built on the Instriptum toolchain and can only run in a browser or in Node.js. So he wanted to run Python in the sandbox and run it locally. So there was WASI, or WebAssembly System Interface, and WASM Time, which is the runtime environment for that. So he took a look at that and then found that maybe he could make a small version of executable Python inside of that, which is kind of part of this whole plugin architecture thing. So the rest of the piece dives into his research. He is very big on LLMs. If you aren't familiar with Simon's research, he uses Codex Desktop to run a bunch of experiments. He provides the prompts, the returning code, markdown files. So again, if you want to see some examples on agentic coding and kind of workflow type of stuff in this, I think it might be very educational for that. Codex ended up writing up, I think it was like 70-something lines of C code for him. He had Claude checking his work, so he's kind of going back and forth between these different tools. In the end, he has a package that you can now try out on PyPI, MicroPython-WASM, and it's an alpha. Alpha warnings on the box, so be aware. he also shows how to get it running with his tool called Dataset Agent, so you can kind of directly query back and forth, LLM style, chat style, pools of data inside of Dataset. So interesting project. And again, just sort of building on this idea of why a lot of people are interested in WASM, this idea of like having things be sandboxed and the ability to run Python in these controlled environments. So I think there's a lot of interesting information there, depending on how you want to approach either LLM production or agentic coding, stuff you can learn. All right, so what do you got next here?
My next bit is some real Python content about the subprocess module. It's available in both written tutorial and video course format. The tutorials by Ian Curry, entitled The Subprocess Module, Wrapping Programs with Python, while the video course is by Stephen Loyens and is called Using the Python Subprocess Module. If you're not familiar, subprocess contains functions for calling other programs on your operating system. So the sub in subprocess comes about because when you run a program, your OS creates a process, which is an abstraction of the thing being run. Your program can actually have multiple processes, but by default, it gets one. The subprocess functions kick off a new process to run a new program, then give you tools for interacting with it as it's going. And in the simplest case, you just let it run and return, and then, but you can do fancier stuff than that as well if you want. When a process kicks off a subprocess, the new process is known as a child. Just how you do that depends on your operating system, but you don't have to worry about that as Python wraps all those details up for you in the module. The tutorial spends a bit of time on just what these processes look like and even teaches you some of the tools available to you on your OS to examine those processes so you can kind of get a better picture of what's happening underneath the covers. To learn more about how subprocess works, though, you need a program to call. So the first step is to create a simple, well-defined one that you write yourself. So the tutorial shows you timer.py, which is a short program that takes a command line argument and then calls sleep for the number of seconds given in that argument. Along the way, it prints out a couple messages so you can better understand what happens to output from your child processes. Once you've got that short program to tinker with, now it's time to actually call it from another program. And thankfully, the REPL is another program. So for a quick first demonstration, you just fire that up and then import the run function from the subprocess module. Run runs the program that you name, waits for it to return, and then returns a completed process object. So the arguments to run take a little getting used to. It takes a list of strings. The list contains what you would actually call in the terminal. So to run timer.py, the list needs three strings. First, Python, the actual program you're running. Then timer.py, which is the name of the script, which is actually an argument to the Python program. Then finally, the number of seconds you want to sleep, which is an argument to timer.py itself. So using a Python program as the example thing that's being called from subprocess for Python is a little confusing because Python programs aren't actually programs, but let's not get into that. So you have to note that the number that you're expressing, as in the number of seconds to sleep, is also a string because all command line arguments are strings, which is why the timer.py code uses argparse to try and handle all of that kind of good stuff. If you load all this up inside of the REPL, then it will spit out the print messages from timer.py. It'll sleep for however many seconds you give it, and then it returns a completed process object. The completed process object that is returned by run contains information about the thing that you called, as well as a return code from the program. All processes return an integer indicating success or failure. This is for historical reasons. Zero means success, and any other number is an error code. As your timer.py function doesn't explicitly set the exit value, Python returns a zero by default. So whether or not you're realizing it, you are actually returning zero. Since timer.py requires an integer argument, if you try to run it without that, you're going to get an error. That argparse thing that I mentioned, it checks for your argument, and if the argument is invalid, it raises an exception, which causes the interpreter to exit with a different value. It's 2, which is arbitrary and not really important. It's just non-zero. This isn't specific to subprocesses runs, so if you called timer.py in your bash script, you could also access that very same number. So getting back a number for a return code isn't very Pythonic, though. So if you'd prefer to have an exception triggered, there is an optional argument to the run function called check. Setting that to true means an exception gets raised when the return code is non-zero instead. Another issue you might run into when invoking another program is it locking up. Since run waits until your child process returns, if that child process ends up stuck in a loop, it won't ever return. You can get around this with the timeout argument to run, which allows you to set a maximum number of seconds to wait for the child process to return. If your child process takes longer than that, run kills it and then raises a timeout expired exception. And this is why timer.py is a little timer program, because now you can play with timeout expired by invoking run with a timeout value that is smaller than the sleep argument to your script in order to see all this in action. Both the course and the tutorial are very comprehensive. I've only skimmed the surface here. The subprocess module includes more complex ways of invoking a child process, allowing you to interact with it, sending data to it, and receiving data back. Also, when you run a program in a terminal, you're actually using a special kind of program known as a shell. By default, when you invoke a child process, you're not using the shell, but there are cases where you might want to, and subprocess is a way of letting you do that as well. If all of that doesn't sound fun enough, well, you have the added joy of how subprocess interacts with other libraries such as async.io and threading. Lots to dig into here, and whether you want to read Ian's tutorial or watch Stephen's course, you'll learn a whole bunch.
Do you have uses other than like general timer, like things that you do with subprocess?
Yeah, you're typically triggering it when you want something else in the operating system that is painful to do in Python and is already there for free.
Yeah.
And sometimes you do it in interaction mechanisms. So although, you know, the examples I've talked about are command line examples, most Unix operating systems have an open command, which in your GUI mechanism allows you to open any arbitrary thing. So if you wanted your Python script to launch, say, Firefox, you could kick off a subprocess and cause that to happen.
Right.
You may also use it in the case of, like I mentioned there, that there's that whole data in, data out thing, right? So let's say there was a piece of commercial software that was connecting to a server. You don't have access to the API and you've got like the in and out from that piece of software on the terminal. You could connect to it through Python, push commands down into it, read the stuff right. That comes back. And so it allows Python to basically be a wrapper around other programs.
Yeah.
Anything, you know, most of the like trivial stuff, like, you know, listing a file directory, you could call the ls command in theory and parse it. There's tools built in Python that are better to do that. So it tends to get used in more complex situations.
Right. Opening and closing other things in the background that are necessary for processes you're trying to do.
Yeah, or where the program is so complicated that replacing it with like a few lines of Python isn't a thing, right? So
yeah. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python resource. Do you feel it's time to stop copy-pasting Python code from ChatGPT and learn to build projects with an AI agent that lives inside your codebase? If AI only helps you with small tasks, you're not using the wrong AI, you're using the wrong workflow. The developers who learn agentic coding workflows now will be building at a different speed 6 months from now. Our 2-day live course gets you there. It's titled Codex for Python Developers. Hands-on agentic coding. Previous guest and Real Python core team member, Philip Ixeni, takes you through getting oriented, the agent in your terminal, scaffolding a project from a single prompt that you can use for all your future Python projects, integrating Git and GitHub handled by the agent, setting project conventions and making the agent follow them, building your first feature end-to-end and finding and fixing what's broken. And finally, you'll be building a fully-fledged terminal app with UV that Codex can access from anywhere on your system. It's a 2-day course. Both days are 4 hours of live, hands-on instruction via Zoom. You code along in real time with Q&A available throughout. Check out the live course. It's scheduled July 11th and 12th. You can enroll today at realpython.com/live. That's realpython.com/live. Going back to a comment that Mr. Trudeau made earlier about type checking, my next piece is actually on the Pyrefly blog. Pyrefly is one of a recent crop of type checkers in the Python ecosystem. And the piece is by previous guest Marco Gorelli, the author of Narwhals. He's also worked on Polars, Python Polars, which will come up here in a minute. Gotta love the title, though. Are you really expected to run 5 type checkers now? So the first line that's under that is MyPy, Pyrefly, Pyrite, Ty, T-Y, and Zubon, which I'm not familiar with, and possibly more that will come in the future. How are library maintainers expected to cope? A big question mark on the end of both of these things. So the key thing that he wants to convey in there is, again, something I'll just read briefly. If you read one section of this blog post, please make it this one, because this is where a lot of packages get it wrong, or I guess package maintainers. It's common to see packages run type checkers on their source code and leave their tests untyped. That approach has it backwards. And so the key idea here is a lot of people might be bending over backwards to try to use all these different types of type checkers inside of their main code, but they might want to focus much more on how other people are going to use their code. And this is something that I thought about a long time ago when I first got into Python, and I'll probably repeat this a little bit more in a minute, but type checking to me always made sense of like, how are other tools going to use your software and making sure that they understand what is accepted and going in and going out. And I think this kind of reiterates that idea. If you maintain a Python package, users don't really care about how you run your development process and practices. It doesn't really affect them, but what they do interact with is your API, and how it works matters to them. So run whatever type checker. These are, again, kind of Marco Gorelli's words inside of this piece here. He's saying run whatever type checker works for you on the internal source code. By running multiple type checkers on your test suite, though, you ensure your package's public API works for as many users as possible. Marco worked on Python Polars, which we talk about often. Polars is a very popular package. He describes what it would take to add Pyrefly to Polars' continuous integration jobs. And this often leads to creating multiple overloads to get a particular function to satisfy the type checker. And to get it to satisfy MyPy, Pyrefly, and Tie, he shares some code. And just a note, I think this is where a lot of people who are new or intermediate to Python start to scratch their head. And this is kind of what your comment was earlier. You start to look at this code, and it's got all of these different symbols that are not things that you learn in fundamental Python. You have like these arrows that are in there. You got, okay, what? Why is there a colon here? Why are there pipe symbols? It all starts to look really foreign. And it's actually one of the reasons that I did a type checking course really early on at my time at Real Python, because I was like, what is this stuff? This doesn't look like Python. It was actually just after I'd done the decorators course, because I'm like, what is this at symbol? As I was reading other people's code, that stuff was the stuff that was very unparsable to me. So he shares this code for the dunder EQ method, checking for equality, and that should return a Boolean, right? But it has four different type ignore comments for seven lines of code, and it leads toward this polluted, difficult to sort of parse code. The next piece of code is looking from the opposite direction. Instead of putting all your internals through multiple type checkers, why not start by testing that all major type checkers can be used by your library's public API? That's much more useful. Again, this is kind of reading a quote from his piece here. So it's easier to justify spending time on it, but it's also easier because you're just ensuring that if your library gets used as intended, then there are no type errors. He also has a little summary. I think Marco likes to do this, which is great. A TLDR, prioritize running as many type checkers as possible on your test suite. Run at least one on your source code. And I think it's good advice. I think you could kind of end up chasing your tail to use multiples of these tools at the same time, because they all kind of have a slightly different way of overriding interesting situations. He provides not only that code block of the confusing stuff of like trying to do this internally inside your own package, looking it through the test suite, that code reads a little bit easier, I think. And I think it's interesting that he was able to write this and have it on the Pyrefly blog, but I think it's good information now, especially since there's just this huge influx of all these different tools for type checking, and it becomes... And it's a moving target too. I mean, I've talked about, I don't know how many times in our annual Python release, we'd have our friend Gerarna do the type checking enhancements and changes and so forth. So, but anyway, I think it's good advice across the board.
I wonder if somebody'd be interested in writing a PEP about like standardizing Pragma ignores.
Yeah.
So like something that is like a particular comment that is always used as a Pragma ignore, and then like an indicator for the tool. And maybe you could use like a star for all tools or something, because I find it all the time. It's like, it's not so much with the typing stuff because I don't use it all that much, but it's like when I use the coverage tools, it's always like, I don't know, I got to have the Pragma here because I need to signal that I don't want that thing checked. And it's always, oh, how do they do it here? It's kind of a loose convention. So
does this idea make sense to you though? Like this idea of like, you should be looking from the outside in versus people thinking of working on the inside and their package.
Yeah. And it comes back to, you know, as much as I joke about not really liking the types and annotation stuff, I think it's a very, very powerful tool. And I use it in places like, you know, FastAPI, Django Ninja, those are things.
Right.
And those are all the outside facing things, right? The public interface piece, right, is that's where people need the information. And that's the boundary between you and the people calling your code. That's the place where you're going to cause the most damage if they send the wrong thing in, and get you into duck typing space, right? Inside of your code, it catches certain kinds of bugs. It's up to you to decide how much overhead is involved in catching those bugs versus how often those bugs happen. Yeah. But I think the API space is a logical place for these kinds of tools, right? So yeah, looking at the tests is probably a good place for it.
Yeah, it's kind of sobering advice because I feel like it definitely seems like an escalation of libraries in the last year and a half.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of that XKCD comic about standards, right? It's like, oh, we have 14 standards. Well, someone should write a standard so that we only need one. Oh, wait, now we have 15 standards. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, let's move on from standards into some projects.
Sure.
What do you got here?
It's summertime, which is optimal star viewing season. Well, maybe not optimal. You tend to get more smog and the sun goes down later, but who wants to be out in the cold in the middle of the night? So if astronomy is your thing, I've got a project for you. It's called Starplot, and it's by Steve Berardi. This is a pretty comprehensive library for generating star charts, including maps with customizable projections, zenith and horizon charts, and a bunch of other stuff. It even allows you to simulate what you'll see based on where and when you're pointing your telescope. The library comes with data, so you don't have to connect to a back end or get your own content. And the data is built in using DuckDB, so it's actually a pretty speedy little thing. It goes along pretty quickly. To use the library, you define an observer object containing the location and time of the viewpoint, so where you are and when you'll be looking, and then you create a plot object depending on what kind of map you want to generate. You then can modify the plot object, doing things like filtering by the star's magnitude, changing the display labels, adding horizon lines, constellation labels, all that kind of good stuff. And then finally, you take that and you call an export method on it to create an image. The library supports PNG, SVG, and JPEG. And that's it, with like 10 to 20 lines of code, depending on how much customization you want and whether or not you're black formatting, you've got a star chart. So there's a lot of great variety here to take advantage of.
Nice.
If you're interested in astronomy, I'll just remind you that we have three different video courses on the subject at RealPython. The first teaches you how to use pandas and matplotlib to visualize astronomical data. The second adds the use of the AstroPy library and NumPy to calculate and visualize optimal viewing times. And the third course is about quasars and teaches you how to use Marimo to create an interactive notebook that helps you calculate redshift. Even if astronomy isn't your thing, what all three of these courses have in common is using real-world data, which means the whole data cleaning thing before producing results. Astronomy is just a fun way to learn a bit more about data science. Quick shout out to Giuliano DiNuno, my co-creator for these three courses, the guy who brought the actual astronomy knowledge. It's nice to have an astrophysicist on call.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of Marimo, you've got something with that this week.
Yeah, yeah. I have two quickies here. So for my fellow Marimo fans out there, the first one is called Marimo-Tutorials. It's a collection by Haleshot. It's spelled H-A-L-E-S-H-O-T on GitHub. It features a variety of notebooks here. I got like, I think five of them. There's a collaborative filtering and a machine learning one. Under the data science category, there's an exploratory data analysis one. Signal and image processing. Literally, there's an image processing and a signal processing one. Separate notebooks there for you to work through and use as a tutorial to not only learn, I think, a little bit about each of those subjects, but also learn a little bit more about Marimo. A collection of tutorials for you there. My second one is, I just thought I'd include it as a separate thing because it's pretty quick also, but I liked it. It looks kind of nice for people that are maybe doing data analysis or looking at, in this case, for trends. It's called PyTrendy, Trend Detection in Python, Applicable for Real World Industry Use Cases in Time Series. So this one's by Russell Semet Bonici, Russell SB on GitHub. PyTrendy is as they've called it, a robust solution for identifying and analyzing trends in time series. It's unique in that it can move from robust to noisy and flat segments and handles gradual and abrupt trend cases with high precision. So it lets you analyze across the time series and see all these different areas be highlighted. It not only plots the graphs for that, but it can highlight with different colors where the different trends are happening inside of it. What I really liked about it is that it has sort of a live notebook tutorial included as part of like the manual for the thing. It uses a separate tool from Marimo, something called Jupyter Lite, which I think I talked about a very long time ago, but it's another one that can be hosted pretty easily. And again, I think this will work really well for data scientists looking to learn not only the library, but maybe get a chance to play a little bit with Jupyter Lite there. Includes an example gallery. Yeah, the idea here is you're looking at time series data and you want to see what trends are happening, and you can see, you know, where things are moving up or down, where abrupt trends are happening, where certain spikes are happening, find out what's gradual information versus high noise information. I think it might be a handy tool for people that are looking to analyze trends. All right, well, that takes us to the end of the episode here. Thanks for bringing all these articles and projects this week, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
All right, man. Talk to you soon. And don't forget, use data-driven to hone your Python on the problems that decide whether you pass or fail the interview. Get pushed on edge cases, scale, and failure modes. Data-driven helps you find your gaps and fix them so you can walk in with true confidence knowing you're ready. Go ace your next Python interview at datadriven.io. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.